From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. As a holiday week begins, the White House today welcomed the official Christmas tree and a heroic military dog. The Prime Minister of Bulgaria is also meeting with President Trump, but much of the attention in Washington is on Secretary of the Navy Richard Spencer, who was asked to step down yesterday and who wrote a scathing letter of resignation as he exited. And last week's impeachment hearings still echo. Let's bring in NPR Senior Washington Editor and Correspondent Ron Elving. Hi, Ron.
Good to be with you, Robin.
And so this Navy battle is complicated. It's around Edward Gallagher, accused by fellow SEALs of killing civilians and other war crimes. He was only convicted in a military court of posing with a dead corpse, but that enraged right-wing media and the president, who said Gallagher shouldn't also lose his trident pin, the insignia of the SEAL. It turns out it's his fellow SEALs who determine if he loses the pin, but now Gallagher has been dissing Spencer on Fox News, and Republicans are saying that Spencer was sort of navigating this on two levels, and that's where the anger is. What's going on?
The two levels has to do with Spencer's efforts to broker a compromise so that neither the Navy nor the president would need to back down and lose face in public. That was blown up by the president on Twitter over the weekend, and that has now led to his actual resignation. He has said that because of a key principle of good order and discipline, and I'm quoting now from his resignation letter, "I cannot in good conscience obey an order that I believe violates the sacred oath I took in the presence of my family, my flag, and my faith to support and defend the Constitution of the United States." He says that Constitution and the Uniform Code of Military Justice are the shields that set us apart and the beacons that protect us all. And then he says, "It's clear the president and I no longer share the same understanding."
What does that do to the military when the highest up is saying, "I can't follow our commander-in-chief"?
And, well, the conflict here is between the commander-in-chief and, it appears, virtually every other layer of military authority and military discipline, including the admiral in charge of the SEALs and the man in charge of the Navy.
Yeah. Just want to ask you about some of the fallout from last week's impeachment hearings. Devin Nunes, the ranking member in the House Intelligence Committee, a vocal Trump defender throughout those hearings. Well, CNN's reporting that he met with the former Ukrainian prosecutor Viktor Shokin. Now, this is the man the U.S. and other world leaders said was corrupt. Then Vice President Joe Biden pushed Ukraine to fire him. Now reports that Devin Nunes met with him, something he didn't acknowledge in the hearings, and didn't deny when asked directly about it by Maria Bartiromo of Fox News.
Bottom line, were you in Vienna with Shokin?
Yeah, so look, Maria, I really want to answer all of these questions. Criminal activity here. We're working with the appropriate law enforcement agencies. We're going to file all this. Everyone's going to know the truth. But I think you can understand that I can't compete by trying to debate this out with the public media when 90% of the media are totally corrupt.
Ron Elving, he could have said no.
He could have said no, but he said, yeah. Well, of course, he is referring to what he sees as the activity of CNN and other news organizations in reporting on what he did. But he did not deny being in Vienna with Shokin, a person who has been identified not just by Joe Biden, but by many people as having been a problem in terms of Ukrainian corruption, and that they were meeting to, well, to share information about Joe Biden and whatever else Mr. Shokin was peddling. He's been peddling quite a few stories over recent months. So in this particular instance, Nunes is probably right to say, I need to talk to my lawyers and see what we're going to do about criminal activity and accusations of such. But he has a very serious problem back in Congress because his case is going to be brought up before House Ethics in all likelihood.
Yeah, we only have about 30 seconds here. Michael Bloomberg announced he's running to become the 2020 Democratic nominee after saying he wouldn't. What does this do to that race?
It probably doesn't affect it much right away. Mr. Bloomberg is not going to run in the early primaries. He's going to concentrate on Super Tuesday, which doesn't come until March. But it will affect every television viewer in America because he is buying $30 million worth of ads.
Funny how it works out. Billionaire candidates, lots of ads. NPR Senior Washington Editor and Correspondent Ron Elving, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Now to some news you might have missed through the fog of impeachment. The Trump administration says it will force hospitals to disclose the secret rates they negotiate with insurers, though the rule won't go into effect or would not go into effect until 2021. The administration also says insurance companies will have to show patients with a simple online tool what they can expect to pay out of pocket. Here's President Trump at the White House announcing the proposals.
Our goal was to give patients the knowledge they need about the real price of healthcare services. They'll be able to check them, compare them, go to different locations so they can shop for the highest quality care at the lowest cost.
For more, we're joined by John Parkett. He is a former Obama administration official and current health policy expert at Willis Towers Watson. And John, these proposals are part of the Trump administration's push for transparency in the healthcare industry. Can you break down what they actually do?
The Trump administration is asking hospitals to post the rates that they've negotiated with your insurance company on a website that would allow a patient to see how much they would pay when they come in for a procedure. They've asked hospitals to look at 300 different services and specifically put up the prices of those services that are some of the most common services. And then they've asked hospitals to put the rest of their negotiated rates into some sort of file that one could access on the internet. They're also making sure that your insurance company would be doing the same work on the other end. And they're putting the onus on the insurance company to create a consumer-friendly tool that would show you just what you had to pay when you went in for care.
Okay. You know, I'm just thinking for a moment, this plan assumes that people can shop around. And I feel like this might complicate things for those who have private insurance. They just can't go to a place where their insurance isn't accepted. What does this mean for consumers?
It's a great question. And in the price transparency debates within healthcare, there's this concept called shoppable services. And most people who have done thinking about this, hard thinking around this, have said, look, some healthcare services just aren't shoppable. If you're in an ambulance on the way to the hospital with an emergency, you're not in a position to shop. Mm-hmm. But there is some subset of services that are shoppable. For example, if you have a non-emergent procedure that you need done at a hospital, in those cases, price transparency really could help patients make a smart decision.
I see. There's also this caveat here, though. We know that price and quality don't always align in healthcare. Would it make better sense to have a system that accesses both for consumers?
I really think so. The ideal scenario here is we have information about prices and information about the quality of care that you will get if you choose a certain provider. Right now, the Trump administration is pushing on one of those to have price information be more transparent. In general, politicians from both sides have been pushing for quality information for years. It's just really hard to come by. It's really hard to know what is good care because there's so many different confounding factors.
Yes, absolutely. What about hospitals? What would these proposals mean for them?
The hospitals have come out and said, we do not like this at all. They came out right away and announced that they were going to be filing a lawsuit to argue that these new rules from the Trump administration weren't even legal. And I don't want to ascribe to the hospitals exactly why they're doing this, but in general, they have, it's not been their number one thing on their to-do list to post the negotiated rates that they set with insurance companies. Let's assume for a second that we get past all the lawsuits. You know, right now, the enforcement mechanism in this rule is a penalty that would cost $300 a day or about $100,000 over the course of the year. And hospitals are going to look at this penalty and say, well, the cost to implement this would be in that same ballpark. Maybe I should just pay this penalty because at the end of the day, $100,000 for most hospitals is a very, very small fraction of their overall operating revenue. So the hospitals are going to have a real choice here as they go forward with this.
John, one other thing. We've been talking a lot about the 2020 Democratic presidential candidate's healthcare plans, Medicare for All, a public option. And you could see this as the president's response in a way, I would think. He's looking at 2020 and he's running on a platform of transparency in healthcare. But how does this fit into the president's other healthcare proposals? Can you summarize where he stands on healthcare policy right now overall? You kind of touched on that a little bit earlier.
The president has been trying to push transparency as one of his major planks reforming the healthcare system. I can think of two notable attempts. One was around requiring drug manufacturers to post the prices of their prescription drugs in the commercials that they put on TV. Another was a little more obscure. It would require groups called pharmacy benefit managers to be public about the rebates that they negotiate with drug manufacturers. Both of those efforts resulted in rulemaking that was eventually pulled back. And what I'm curious about with this new price transparency effort around hospitals is it going to have the same fate as those two previous efforts where they went public, they created a big splash, they requested comments from industry and other stakeholders, but eventually they were pulled at the end of the day. And given how close we are to the 2020 election right now, I think everyone's kind of sitting here watching and asking, we think they were serious about the last two efforts, but those last two efforts failed. Is this going to be another effort just like that?
Well, as you said, we will all be watching. That's John Barquette. He is a former Obama administration official and current policy expert at Willis Towers Watson. John, thank you so much.
Thanks, Tanya.
Chewing gum, playing on your phone, talking back to a teacher, these are the kinds of behaviors that are sure to get you suspension in some schools. Well, not anymore in the state of California. Beginning next year, all elementary and middle school students in the state will no longer be able to suspend under something called willful defiance. It's a term that's vague and really hard to define, leaving many educators up to their own interpretations of exactly what it means. And data shows that when that happens, Black and brown students bore the brunt of the discipline. Well, we wanted to see what discipline looks like at a school without the option of suspensions. So we went to one in West LA, a school district that did away with willful defiance 7 years ago. But before we take you there, we're joined by NPR education reporter Anya Kamenetz to explain some of the reasons suspensions are problematic. Thank you for joining us, Anya.
Thanks for having me, Tanya.
So in recent years, the rate of suspension nationwide in schools has gone down. But in 2016, Black students were still more likely to get suspended than their white peers. And you've been reporting on this issue for a long time. In your most recent reporting, you found that overall school discipline in the country has gone down, but there are still these racial gaps. Tell us more about it.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the racial gaps get really pronounced when you look at certain subgroups, like, for example, girls. Black girls are 6 times more likely to get suspended than their white peers. We also see very big gaps in the preschool level. So about 4,400 students were suspended from preschool in the most recent year, for which there's federal data, and almost half of those were Black.
So it's important to note that we're talking about normal behavior, like chewing gum or disrupting class, but the punishments, according to the data, is really much harder for Black and brown children, correct?
So I think what we're talking about here is really the question of implicit bias. Are Black and white students going to be judged differently for essentially the same behavior? And just as we see in the criminal justice reform movement, there's starting to be research that shows that there is implicit bias in the population against children. So, for example, a study that was published by the American Psychological Association found that undergraduates, young women, mainly white women, judged children over the age of 10. They judged Black children to be significantly less innocent just based on a photograph than white children. So there's this question of, you know, before you even do anything, are you being judged as being less innocent? And a similar study found very similar things for preschool teachers actually looking at Black and white children and making judgments about who was misbehaving.
And the stakes are really higher. So your child trend analysis, NPR's, found that being suspended or kicked out of class for a Black child can impact the trajectory of that child's life. A lot of us have heard of the preschool to prison pipeline, but can you explain the stakes a little more?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when students are suspended from school, that often starts the process of them becoming less connected to school and dropping out. In certain schools, depending on the presence of a school resource officer or police officer, getting in trouble in school can mean getting arrested at that same time. And that's beginning of having, you know, a record that can follow that child literally for the rest of their lives. And getting suspended in school can increase the chances that they're going to drop out then, which impacts their, you know, everything. Their college and their earnings later on.
Mm-hmm. So back in 2014, the U.S. Department of Education issued guidance on how to identify and avoid what they call discriminatory discipline. Based on your reporting, what are some of the alternatives to suspension and expulsion?
So the concepts people are talking about usually fall into the categories of restorative justice and positive behavior interventions. And the thing is that they all take a lot of time, energy, and training, and they're difficult to implement, without resources. We still have 14 million high school students in this country attending schools that have a police officer but no school counselor or mental health professional. Mm-hmm. And so while I've seen these approaches become, be very, very successful in schools, it's really a wraparound approach. It's social and emotional skills training, it's mindfulness time, it's coaching one-on-one for teachers, helping them have better classroom habits. It's having a place for the students to go, a quiet space for them to go, rather than, be pushed out of class, but maybe a quiet corner. And so it really takes a lot of resources to do well. And I think that's why we're having this kind of raging debate in this country. You mentioned 2014, obviously, that was during the previous administration. And the mm-hmm. conversation post-Parkland has been much more in the direction of, hardening our schools and making our schools tougher rather than these kinds of what has been seen as softer approaches.
That's NPR education reporter Anya Kamenetz. Thank you so much for your time, Anya.
Thank you, Tanya.
Okay, back to that school I was telling you about. Norris Deary Elementary in Los Angeles did away with suspension 7 years ago. Only in the most severe cases will a child be sent home for bad behavior. More than 60% of the students at Norris Deary identify as Hispanic. Black Americans make up about 10% of the school's population, and about 29% are English language learners. Principal Sarah Lansover begins our conversation talking about the problem with willful defiance.
How can you suspend a child or give any consequences to a child for willful defiance when you can't even define what it is?
Principal Lansover wrote her PhD dissertation on discipline and found that keeping kids out of school is fundamentally against what school is actually supposed to offer children.
We need to get these kids ready for being grown-ups and ready for life because life is tough, and we need to be able to get them prepared for that lifestyle or for life in general. But I think oftentimes what isn't taken into consideration in the moment is perhaps what that child is going through, that perhaps they've just had a bad morning. They saw their parents fighting in the morning and they're just having a really terrible day. And the last thing on their mind is school. And all of a sudden the teacher's in their face telling them to get to work. And they're wondering if they're going to see their dad when they get home that night because of this big fight. And I think the teacher's goal is to help the student. The teacher's goal is to teach that student. And if the child's not paying attention, the teacher's first instinct is to get that child to pay attention and get him or her doing their work. And so that could be where a lot of the conflict begins. And then that's the problem, is you end up with conflict. And then sometimes it can elevate.
That escalation often results in Black boys disproportionately disciplined. According to the Department of Education, 25% of all students suspended are Black boys. Black girls make up about 14%, even though both only account for about 8% of the public school population.
The key issue is, how are you punishing a child by taking them out of the classroom? You're punishing them. It leads to that school-to-prison pipeline, which hopefully many people who are listening have heard of. It starts with saying, you're a bad kid and you don't deserve to learn. And that's not okay. So we at the school level need to find another way to help the child perhaps learn their lesson, or perhaps help the child to understand what's going on for their own feelings, to give that child a chance to calm down. If they're upset and they're at that level of where a teacher would want to discipline for willful defiance, they're probably not even at a place where they are able to learn. So the key is calming them down.
And calming kids down requires first assessing their needs.
At my school, we're doing something that not a lot of our schools in the district are doing yet, and I'm really proud of what we're doing. We're doing something called mindfulness. And ours is specifically trauma-informed mindfulness. So anytime a child is sent to me here in the office, which is very rare at my school, fortunately, the first thing I have them do is breathe. Let's calm down, and then let's get to the problem. Let's find out what's going on. And my kids here know that I'm here to help them with the problem that they're having, that I'm here to find out what is the problem, how can we solve it, And who might you have harmed in this process? Let's look at that. Let's look at the fact that your actions have harmed someone else. It may not be physical harm. Mm-hmm. It could be emotional harm. But recognizing that as people, our actions have effects on other people.
But all of this, as you heard earlier, is expensive, and schools have been dealing for a long time with shrinking budgets and demands to get as much learning time in the day as possible.
What would you say to other educators, though, who are listening to this, who say, this sounds great. I mean, I want to teach my kids. I want them to be happy and healthy. But I've got almost 30 kids in my classroom, and I'm dealing with some troubled kids, and I'm just trying to get through the day, and I just want to have a classroom that's not disruptive. This all sounds rosy, but I don't know the first step to get to what you're talking about.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because as I sit here talking to you, I picture the audio file online and all the comments below, thinking, okay, that principal is not living in reality. This is my reality, but I think it is tough. This is not, I make it sound so like it's so easy. It is not easy. It is not easy, but I think it's a matter of changing the culture, being just something simple. There's research that shows something simple as greeting your child as they walk into that classroom every day, and you being able to monitor how that child is feeling when they get into that class. If you're smiling at a child and they're not smiling back at you, maybe take them aside. Hey, I was noticing you're not looking too good. Everything okay? And those, it's not going to happen overnight. It's not going to change overnight.
The state of California will need to invest in teacher training, says Lanceover, and finding alternatives to suspensions.
Norris Dairy, we just have a way about us here, and where we help kids to feel special and important and heard and safe.
Sarah Lasnover, principal at Norris Dairy Elementary School in West LA, thank you so much for this conversation.
You're welcome.
The state of California will implement the no suspension policy for elementary and middle school students beginning next school year. This is Here and Now. Uber shares were down at the open today after news that the ride-hailing app has lost its license to operate in London. Regulators decided to pull Uber's license over reports that unauthorized drivers were picking up passengers, something they say happened more than 14,000 times in late 2018 and 2019. For more, let's bring in Jill Schlesinger, business analyst for CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Hey, Jill, this sounds really creepy. How exactly did this happen?
Well, evidently there was a change to Uber's systems which allowed these unauthorized drivers to upload their photos to other Uber drivers' accounts. And so this allowed them to pick up passengers as though they were the booked driver. So as you said, 14,000 trips, this obviously put passenger safety and security at risk. And the Transport for London, which is the city's main transportation regulator, the TfL, said this lapse meant that all of these trips were uninsured. Some took place with unlicensed drivers. And it's really concerned that Uber's system seemed to have been comparatively easily manipulated.
Okay, question for you. Uber first reported this problem to regulators, who then found it to be more widespread than Uber first reported. How's the company defending itself?
Well, you know, interesting. Jamie Hayward is the regional general manager for Northern and Eastern Europe. And he says the decision to not renew the license in London was what he says, quote, extraordinary and wrong. He says the reason is that, look, we self-reported this. We have been strengthening our driver identification processes over the last couple of months. And in fact, Uber plans to introduce something called facial matching, which would require drivers to look at their smartphone camera and blink, smile, turn their head. And that would be able to verify their identity and would prevent even any sort of photo fraud.
This isn't the first time London has actually revoked Uber's license. The first time was back in 2017 over a whole host of different concerns. Is this more than just about safety, although that is a very salient issue to take on? Or is London cracking down in response to the cab industry's concerns there?
You know, the cab industry was very vocal in the beginning, but I think that that had actually worn off a bit. I think that this is much more of a real safety issue. And the clock kind of started to tick on Uber in September of 2017, because they didn't get a five-year license back then. This was about issues about safety and what they also called corporate culture and governance. Mm-hmm. Uber appealed the decision. This is a 15-month license, which is expired right now, and then expired in September, and then another two-month license, which expires today. And this was supposed to be the time at which Uber could actually respond to the very specific 14,000 instances of these crazy rides.
I see. So for now, Uber is allowed to operate while they are appealing this ruling in London. The appeals process could take months. How big of a blow is this overall to Uber?
You know, I think this company had been under so much pressure. Through Friday, the stock price down by 29% from the IPO this past spring, and they continue to lose money. In their last quarterly report, they said they lost over $1 billion in net losses in the previous 3 months, and they're on track right now for 2019, in the year ahead, to have a loss of between $2.8 and $2.9 billion for the year. So this is a company that is starting to feel the heat. This just adds to it.
Jill Schlesinger, business analyst for CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Jill, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
And we're just days away from the biggest day for home cooks. I may have to leave now to prepare. It is Thanksgiving.
Yes, and recently we put out the call for your questions for Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunst, and we got them from all across the country.
Yeah, we're not going to be able to get to every single one, but Kathy's in the studio to try as many as we can. And just briefly, Kathy, this is so stressful.
If people get really, really stressed, and I understand it because it's a big meal and a lot of people don't even cook very much all year, and then all of a sudden they're having 20 people to dinner. But breathe. A collective breath.
And plan.
Yes. Plan ahead and use your time now. So let me just start with something. If you have a frozen turkey today, take it out of the freezer. Mm-hmm. It takes about 5 pounds per day to defrost. So today's the day to start if you've got a 15 or 20 pound turkey to freeze. That's always like such a big question for people. We got a whole lot of that.
Right. Very good tip. Very good tip. Also, we have a question from Dawn from Mercer Island, Washington. She asks the age-old question, brine or not to brine turkey? Your thoughts?
You know, I'll tell you, many people swear by brining. Quickly, brining is immersing your turkey in salt and spices. Many people believe that it moistens a otherwise, sometimes dry bird. I don't do it. What I do is I melt some butter and olive oil, a whole lot of chopped garlic and herbs, and I just baste my turkey every hour or so.
I thought basting was not happening anymore.
No, basting happens in my kitchen, and my turkey's good.
Okay, well, because there was a big discussion as to whether basting even got through the skin.
Well, you know what? For me, it keeps it really moist. Okay. But if you want a brine, you can do a dry one, which is just coating salt and spices on it, or a wet one where it's in water with bay leaf and peppercorns and your favorite spices.
Okay. Then there's Pam from Plymouth, Wisconsin, and Barbara from Traverse City, Michigan, both wanted to know, if you had a simple recipe for making gravy, I just throw everything in the what is it, the drippings dish.
So here's the thing about gravy. It freaks people out. But let me take you through it, okay? Today, tomorrow, or Wednesday, open up your turkey. You're going to find all those weird parts that you usually just throw out. Don't throw them out. Take the neck, the heart, the gizzards. Maybe even you've bought some extra turkey wings. You could roast them. But you put all these parts into a medium pot with parsley, onion, celery, carrot, peppercorns, and salt, and simmer it for about an hour and a half. You don't have to do anything to it. Just let it be, and you're going to have this beautiful turkey stock. Mm-hmm. So then it's the day of. The turkey's done. Here's a key thing. You take the turkey out, put it on a warm platter, and cover it with a tea towel. You want it to sit for at least 15 to 20 minutes before you try to carve it. So what do you do once the turkey's out of the pan?
Panic.
You put the pan on your stovetop. You turn the heat up. You take a little bit of the fat out, but you scrape all that fabulous stuff at the bottom of the pan. You sprinkle in a little bit of flour.
Yes, my grandma does that.
Strain that gorgeous turkey stock into what's essentially a roux, which is the flour and the turkey fat from the pan. Let that simmer and simmer and thicken and taste it. Does it need some fresh sage, salt, mm-hmm. pepper? Bingo, you have gravy.
Well, quick question. Can you, you know, people talk about Worcester sauce and red wine mm-hmm. and, you know, what are the things that you might want to add while you're stirring mm-hmm. that stuff up the bottom?
I don't mess around with any of that. You can absolutely mm-hmm. add white wine or red wine. You can't have too much turkey. So the more stock you have, maybe you want to buy chicken stock from your favorite store, or a lot of butchers sell turkey stock mm-hmm. the day around mm-hmm. this time of year. The better the stock, the better okay. the gravy.
Okay.
Hey, a question about cranberry sauce. So you have this recipe that listeners ask for every year. You actually yeah. sent me some. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Tell us a little bit more about it.
Well, the most interesting thing to me about it is that, Tanya, you told me this is going to be your first time tasting cranberries.
What? I know. I'm a weirdo. I didn't want you to tell that
on air. Oh, you didn't?
Air,
oh,
but
there
you
I
told
did.
It. Mostly told because it. It's the canned stuff. That's why. Because it grosses me out, the canned stuff. But what you sent me is this fresh, beautiful,
okay.
vibrant cranberry sauce.
Okay,
so
sorry
tell us more
I outed
about it.
This has turned
there.
Into Now It Can Be Told.
That's right. That's right. Okay, exactly. Tanya, please don't, you know, I'm sorry about that. This is fresh cranberries. Mm. I simmer water and sugar. I make like a sugar syrup. You add the cranberries. As soon as they make this wonderful popping sound, you add some orange rind, orange juice, fresh ginger, candied ginger, a little maple syrup. Let it really cook down. It gets nice and thick. Then I add toasted pecans and fresh chopped pineapple.
Pecans, that's what I'm saying.
Yes, but you could use walnuts. You could use anything. What did you think, Tanya? Honesty.
It is absolutely delicious.
Aww.
I mean, now I'm a convert, but okay. I'll have to make this now.
Well, it'll take you about 15, 20 minutes. And today is a great day to make it, even though you're working. But I mean, tonight, that cranberry sauce will keep for 10 days.
Okay. And probably get better over the days. So, Susan Stamberg, the gauntlet has been thrown down.
Yes, that's right.
She makes her cranberry sauce with, what is it?
Horseradish, yeah.
Right. Okay,
delicious.
More listener questions. Sarah from Chicago asked what a lot of people did. And we have a dish here. Sarah, we have what you've been looking for. It's both dairy and gluten-free.
Okay, I just want to tell you that America is on so many special diets. The number mm-hmm. of questions that came in, hi, my husband's vegetarian. Hi, my daughter's gluten-free. Hi, my son's dairy-free. Hi, I'm vegan. Hi, my grandfather's diabetic. Woohoo! Mm-hmm. This mm-hmm. is why people get stressed. Mm-hmm. So I thought, I want to just create one dish that will speak to everybody. And this is a cream spinach, but it is a vegan cream spinach with kale and nutmeg. And what I did was I used coconut oil, sauteed shallots and scallions, fresh nutmeg. If you buy one new thing this week, go get a whole nutmeg. It looks like a brown
fresh,
ball.
Yeah.
And you grate it on your grater, and the nutmeg, the aroma, what it adds to this spinach and kale dish. Then I added coconut milk, simmered it down. It's super creamy and ready. It's dairy-free, it's gluten-free, it's vegetarian, it's vegan. It hits
it's
every box.
So
and it's delicious.
Good.
I don't
it's
think
so
I'm going to make it with heavy cream ever again.
It's so good.
But the biggest thing that I want to say for all the vegans and vegetarians is that the turkey is always considered the star. It's almost like a flower arrangement in the middle of the table. Yeah. It's the symbol that tells you it's Thanksgiving. But to
That's
be perfectly
true.
Honest, it's the side dishes that you love
that
and
it.
Look forward to.
That's
but
right.
the problem is that they're called side dishes.
Yeah.
And I think if you reorient yourself, you don't have to rethink Thanksgiving a whole lot. Brussels sprouts, mashed potatoes, sweet potatoes, cornbread stuffing. All
yes.
of that is the best part.
Things with marshmallow.
It is. Okay. Yeah, absolutely.
Nah, not so much.
But Kathy.
Yeah, go ahead.
We have so many questions, so I want to get to Eric from Austin, Texas. He has a dilemma that a lot of people have. He only has one oven, and he asks if you have any tips, tricks, or magic for pulling off the turkey plus all of the sides without at least one dish getting cold.
Yeah, it's such a good question, because let's assume that you have one oven, you have one stovetop with four burners, and you have one sink and one refrigerator.
Most people?
Yes, absolutely. So how do you do this? Pie crust can be made 2 to 3 days ahead of time. Pies can be baked the night before. So the whole mm-hmm. dessert element is done. A lot of side dishes can be made ahead of time, but I am a stickler on mashed potatoes. I want them fresh. Right. I want them made day of. You can make them a day ahead of time, but mash some more milk and cream or stock into it if you're doing it that day. The squash, the string beans can be steamed ahead of time. This spinach and kale dish can be made ahead of time. Maybe you're roasting chestnuts. All of that do ahead of time. So you roast the turkey and it takes up almost the whole oven, right?
The other star of this day is aluminum foil.
You just yes, that's true.
Make everything and wrap everything
but
up.
Once you take your turkey out, you have this very hot, empty oven. And that's when you can throw in all your side dishes. You can keep things warm. So it really just takes planning. If you have to, use a cooler. If you live in the Northeast or you live in the Northwest where it's cold, use a windowsill. Use an outdoor porch table. You just have to make the most with what you have so that it's not you're ready to sit down and suddenly all four burners are busy, but you have to heat up the spinach and the mashed potatoes.
Plan. Yeah. Do a graph, charts and graphs. we've been talking Thanksgiving questions with Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunst. We got a lot from you, and thank you for that. Her recipes, we'll have it herenow.org. I'm telling you, cream spinach, we can't say that. It's coconut spinach. It's just fantastic.
Vegan cream spinach. Vegan.
Kathy, thanks so much.
Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving to all. Mm-hmm.
It's one of the world's biggest consumers of coal, but it plans to phase out coal by 2038. And lawmakers are considering a plan to shut down dozens of coal-fired power plants as part of this goal. And then they have another bigger goal, to be emissions neutral by 2050. Claudia Kempfert is professor of energy economics at the German Institute for Economic Research. She joins us from Berlin. And Professor, just catch us up where we are at this point, because we'd heard reports that there was an initial plan to tell coal-fired plants they had to shut down by a certain time. But we understand maybe it's not going to be that harsh.
Well, it's still under debate. What they are right now doing at the German government is to establish some kind of climate law where they would like to focus on a coal phase-out plan. And in this plan or in that law, in addition, also they are talking about some kind of financial compensations. And if we are phasing out coal, we have to phase in more renewables. And there's a big debate right now. Whether we should have a steeper increase of wind or solar, and how fast can we shut down coal-fired power plants, and what about the compensations for the utilities? That's still under debate right now.
Well, so you said something important there, that, you know, the initial plan, at least it was reported that there was an initial plan that utilities would be forced to deactivate these hard coal power plants by 2026 if not enough closures happened voluntarily. But now you mentioned that there's going to be these subsidies and things to encourage operators to close the coal plants on their own. But that means that shutting down coal in the country is going to cost more.
Well, it depends on what they are deciding right now, because in that moment, the German government has decided to pay 40 billion by 2038 for those regions which are affected from this coal phase out, primarily those regions where a lot of coal jobs are located. And the other concept which you just mentioned is, what about the climate law and how voluntary or how fixed will be the coal phase-out plan? And there's still a debate right now. It's these days where they are heavily debating also in the parliament, and we will see what kind of solutions they are favoring.
And how are people reacting to this? You mentioned the jobs that would have to be switched to either new jobs or just phased out completely, that of coal workers. Will renewables pick up not just enough of the energy production, but enough of the jobs to satisfy Germans?
Yeah, I mean, the population is very confident that the energy transition is right and they are supporting it. 80% of the people think that that's a good strategy. But the way how to do it, it's quite under debate right now. And we have still 40,000 coal jobs in those regions, and in the renewable sector, approximately 300,000 people are working right now. But there is some kind of market problems in the renewable energy sector. So a lot of solar jobs has been lost and wind these days as well. So there is a big debate how to solve it and also to maintain also the renewable energy jobs and not only to phase out coal and give a financial compensation for coal, but also to give a financial compensations for those jobs, the future jobs of renewables. And this is a big debate right now, and it has all to do with a phase-out plan.
Well, it might also include nuclear plants, because we remember Germany decided to shut down its nuclear plants after the Fukushima disaster in 2011 in Japan. A dozen of the country's nuclear plants have been closed, and so renewables have to pick up some of those jobs and that energy production as well. But you just said something so interesting, that 80% of the country is behind this coal industry shutdown, at least hard coal. It's just, you know, so interesting, because here, of course, in this country, we had a candidate who ran for president promising to keep the coal jobs. And it's the market that seems to have determined things, because here in the U.S., American coal companies are going bankrupt. Mm-hmm. Was this part of the issue in Germany, or is it strictly to try to meet the emissions goals?
Well, it is under debate also that there is a market influence here, because also in Germany, as you have just described for the U.S., it's the same situation, that the coal companies are struggling. So it's quite under debate of what they are doing. And at the end, whether there's such kind of high payment or not. Mm-hmm. But the Germans are really much, as you said, also confident that we should meet the emission reduction goals. And therefore, the coal phase-out plan is not under question anymore. And in Germany, we are willing to pay subsidies or financial compensation, but not to that large extent as nowadays is discussed.
Yeah. And where does Germany stand in Europe in its stance on phasing out coal?
Well, we have in Germany the largest amount or the largest share of coal in comparison to all other European countries. There's another country which has also quite high share, which is Poland. But they have also now they are debating a strategy how to decrease the share. And in other countries, as you mentioned, France has more nuclear power plants than Germany. But Germany is phasing out nuclear, then phasing out coal and phasing in renewables. And this plan is still ongoing. But there's still a long way to go.
Claudia Kempfert, professor of energy economics at the German Institute for Economic Research, says that country looks to phase out its coal industry. Professor Kempfert, thank you.
Thank you.
And here now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here Now.